What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Syria says its forces have seized another town from Islamic State, Karyatan, in the central part, a week after retaking the historic city of Palmyra. State media said the seizure of Karyatan with support of Russian airstrikes gives the government a strategic victory by securing oil and gas routes between Damascus and oil fields to the east. Mideast analyst Stephen Zunis of the University of San Francisco says recent IS losses can be directly linked to the six-week-old cessation of hostilities.
As a result, it's become more difficult for the IS to hold on to the territories that they had seized earlier during the civil war.
Meanwhile, in Iraq, government forces have reportedly taken control of the northern edge of the IS-held town of Hit west of Baghdad. South Africa's parliament is to open debate Tuesday on an opposition motion to impeach President Jacob Zuma for violating the Constitution. The Constitutional Court ruled last week Mr. Zuma failed to uphold, defend, and respect the Constitution by failing to pay back some of the public funds he used to make improvements on his private home. More than $20 million in remodeling, including a swimming pool, an amphitheater, and a fenced-in area for cattle. The Federal Anti-Corruption Office ordered him to repay the funds spent on renovations unrelated to security. Mr. Zuma, speaking Sunday in his native KwaZulu-Natal province, said, "Whether you are a Zuma or not, I have been given a task to be your shepherd." The embattled leader last week said he never knowingly or deliberately set out to violate the Constitution, which is the supreme law of the Republic. His ruling African National Congress dominates Parliament. Any effort to impeach him is expected to fail. This is VOA News. Turkey is preparing for the return of hundreds of migrants Monday under a controversial plan to stem illegal migration into Europe. The operation is set to begin on the Greek island Lesbos, where thousands of migrants are being held. In Pakistan Sunday, heavy rains triggered flash floods, landslides, and collapsed roofs that killed at least 45 people and injured dozens in the country's northwest. Meanwhile, in Lahore, hundreds Sunday held a candlelight vigil, marking 1 week since a suicide bombing at a popular park that killed 75 people. The Pakistani Taliban-linked group Jamaat-ul-Rahar claimed responsibility, saying it was targeting Christians. Irfan Jamil is Lahore's bishop.
All the Christians and the Muslims and Hindus also here, just to show our solidarity with all those who have lost their life in this bomb blast, and also to pray for the injured and encourage the people that these handful of people should not be able to overtake the whole country. And we are all praying for the army and the government as they are trying to do their best to restore the situation.
Meanwhile, Pakistan's military says it's killed more than 250 militants while losing 8 soldiers in counterinsurgency operations near the country's border with Afghanistan. The first passenger plane took off from the airport in Brussels Sunday, where suicide bombers carried out a deadly attack nearly 2 weeks ago. The blast there at a nearby metro station killed 32, destroyed the airport's departure area. Mark Dieschenmacher is chairman of the Brussels Airport Company.
This is a very symbolical, but also a very emotional moment for the airport community. It's the first flight after the terrorist attack. We're turning a page full of blood. But we have to rebuild this airport, and we will do so.
A Brussels Airlines plane heading to the Portuguese city Faro was the first of 3 flights scheduled to leave the airport late Sunday. More than 11 million documents from files of a Panama-based law firm leaked Sunday exposed the dealings of hundreds of thousands of clients. The so-called Panama Papers covered a period of 40 years. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, a German newspaper, and more than 100 other news organizations. So the documents from the Mossack Fonseca law firm reveal associates of Russian President Vladimir Putin moved as much as $2 billion through offshore bank accounts. A second case of Ebola has been reported in Liberia, where a 30-year-old woman died of the deadly virus last Thursday. She had been traveling to neighboring Guinea, where several fatal cases have been reported since February. She died at a Monrovia hospital. Her 5-year-old son is also said to be ill. Last week, the World Health Organization announced Ebola was no longer an international health emergency, but cautioned flare-ups remain possible. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, April 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundi welcomes the adoption of a United Nations Security Council Resolution 2279.
I think that what the resolution is talking about is not the police force, but the police contribution. And we think that it is not exactly against the interests of the Republic of Burundi, because what we are opposed to, it is the idea of troops.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. Cameroon's opposition protest President Paul Biya's long stay in power in defiance of police. Zimbabwe's indigenization minister gives a second deadline for companies to comply before their licenses are revoked. And Liberia confirms a new Ebola flare-up in the country.
Liberia has confirmed another case of the Ebola virus disease, making it two cases from our investigation. There are strong indications that this is an imported case linked to the cluster in Guinea right now.
Tolbo Nyenswa is Liberia's deputy health minister and head of the country's Ebola incident management system. Researchers developed a new generation of polio vaccine, and a Sudanese tea seller is honored for her courage in organizing a women's food and tea cooperative in Khartoum. Those stories plus Marco Oman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The Burundian government says it welcomes the adoption of UN Security Council Resolution 2279, which calls for the deployment of a United Nations police contingent to monitor the security situation in Burundi. The resolution, passed on Friday, also calls on all parties to reject any kind of violence and public statements that incite hatred. It urges the Burundian government to guarantee fundamental freedoms for all and adhere to the rule of law. Burundian Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe says President Pierre Nkurunziza's government has always been open to an international presence in Burundi and would welcome the deployment of the police contingent as long as they are not UN troops.
I think that what the resolution is talking about is not the police force, but the police contribution. And we think that it is not exactly against the interests of the Republic of Burundi, because what we are opposed to, it is the idea of troops. But we've always said that we are open for an international presence. This is, by the way, materialized by the presence of AU human rights monitors and AU military experts. The resolution calls on the Secretary General to present options after consultation with the government of Burundi. So we are expecting to hear from him, but already they know our position, which remains the same. We are not demander of a force to come in Burundi. We would be very much welcoming a contribution in terms of experts' contribution to our police force, but no troops.
Would your government welcome if these troops came in with arms?
You know, if you look at the resolution itself, is mum on those aspects. We are yet to hear from the UN Secretary General, but like we said, we are not in favor of anything force. But maybe what's more important for us is to understand that the resolution itself is a well-balanced text, which does not go in line with condemning the government, as some members of the council or some people in the international community have done so over the last month.
Minister, the resolution strongly condemns human rights violations in your country, particularly mentioning, for example, extrajudicial killings, torture, intimidation. Some of these have been linked to the security forces in your country.
That's a very good question, James. But I always say that it is easy to indict, it is easy to accuse without any form of investigation. Now that we're having monitors on the ground, now that we are about to have UN, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, coming to Burundi to look into all those allegations, let's wait. Why are we in a hurry? Why should we accuse the government on basis of hearsay or what NGOs talk about without having done the due processing?
As you know, the resolution also talks about the persistent political impasse in the country and calling for a genuine and inclusive inter-Burundian dialogue. So where are we?
Well, it all depends, again, from which perspective are you looking at issues. Let's say that as far as we are concerned, we as a government have done our best. We have catered for the Burundians, at least those who are inside the country, to engage in a dialogue and debate. Now, if we need to talk about dialogue outside the country, we have said that we have no opposition to that principle. What we have to work on is the list of participants and on the timetable and on topics to be discussed. And you agree with me that even the Security Council has agreed that those are issues that need to be agreed upon. How do you want us to take seriously people who have vowed to remove the government by force?
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. Health officials in Liberia say a five-year-old boy has tested positive for Ebola just days after his mother died of the virus. A 30-year-old woman died of Ebola in Monrovia last week, months after Liberia was declared free of the virus. Her death followed a recent flare-up that cost the lives of at least four people in neighboring Guinea. Deputy Health Minister and head of the country's Ebola Incident Management System, Talbo Nyesua, says the latest flare-up has been traced back to Guinea. But he said, unlike the past, Liberia's health system has the capacity to deal with the flare-up.
Liberia has confirmed another case of the Ebola virus disease, making it two cases. The index case of the deceased mother, 30-year-old, and now her 5-year-old son is in the Ebola treatment unit in Monrovia. But this is something that we are comfortable dealing with right now because of the capacity that the country has to respond through our incident management system. Our health system now have capacity to deal with this. Both human resource, epidemiologists, healthcare workers, our colleagues working in the Ebola treatment unit now providing care to this 5-year-old child that the mother brought from Guinea into Liberia. Three children she brought with her into Liberia. From our investigation, there are strong indications that this is an imported case from Guinea linked to the cluster in Guinea right now.
2 weeks ago, we spoke with the Minister of Information when there was this flare-up in Guinea, and Liberia had closed its border. The minister also indicated that you had sent medical personnel to crossing points along the border with Guinea. The question is, what happened?
Government is sensitive about the Ebola virus disease in the region, took the preliminary actions, very proactive with that, to assess the capacity of our health team at the border for testing and all of that. This is the kind of plurality of the border. The border is so porous. There are some that are official, there are some that are unofficial. And so this is the situation that we are faced with.
What happened to the people who were in contact with these people, the person?
When I talk about 99.9% contact tracing here, in less than 24 hours, our system was able to pick up the clinic that she went to and died. We're able to pick up healthcare workers who are contacts of that. They are under voluntary precautionary observation. We're able to pick up the family members that she was visiting in Liberia. All of them are in the ETU. You know, the son is now positive and receiving care in the ETU.
Liberia was declared Ebola-free in January. What would you say to the many Liberians who might be fearful now that this virus might be coming back to Liberia?
What is important is that we urging residents and citizens of our country to remain kind. There is no need for panic. We're taking all preventive measures, and everybody should take those measures, report sick people, hand washing, report dead bodies. In as much as we were Ebola-free, we didn't let our guards down. We're still giving the kind of heightened surveillance, vigilance, and testing every sick people and their bodies.
Talbo Nyesua is Liberia's Deputy Health Minister and head of the country's Ebola Incident Management System. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Today is Monday, April 4th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Even as the number of polio cases worldwide dwindles to near zero, health officials stress the need for continued vigilance against a resurgence. Researchers have developed a new vaccine that would not cause an outbreak if the virus accidentally escaped a manufacturing plant. VOA's Jessica Burma explains.
Only 74 cases of polio were reported in the entire world last year. Public health officials are looking ahead to a day when the paralytic disease is completely eradicated. To ensure that there's never another outbreak, the aim is to continue vaccinating every child. But the virus that causes polio survives in biocontainment facilities, where it's processed into an inactive form that is the basis of the vaccine. And there's a small possibility that it could escape back into the general population. Jerome Custers is a senior vaccine scientist at Janssen Infectious Disease and Vaccines in the Netherlands, a subsidiary of the pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson.
Allowing that, you really need viruses that are safer to work with, so less virulent, not disease-causing. Because a few years ago, in a facility from another pharmaceutical company, there was an accidental release of poliovirus in a river.
Custer says luckily nothing has happened and no one was infected. But now a second-generation vaccine developed by a lead team of Dutch researchers would virtually eliminate the risk of a polio outbreak caused by escaped virus. In the journal PLOS Pathogens, investigators report the development of cold-adapted vaccine strains that are unable to multiply inside the human body. The viral strains used to make the new vaccine were engineered so they can only grow when in temperatures of about 30 degrees Celsius. That's much colder than the normal human body temperature of 37 degrees. If manufacturers were to begin using this new cold-adapted strain of polio, it would lower the risk of an accidental outbreak, because even if the virus was accidentally released into the environment, it wouldn't be able to grow inside the body of anyone who came into contact with it. Custer says beyond the threat of an outbreak, there's an inadequate supply of the current injectable vaccine, plus it's also fairly expensive to make. Buddy notes a vaccine using the cold strain ultimately could be cheaper to make and many more doses could be produced. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Opposition supporters in Cameroon has defied police and continued their protests against efforts by the ruling party to organize early elections. The opposition says Cameroon's 84-year-old president, Paul Biya, wants to be president for life after 34 years already in office. Several protesters have been wounded and or arrested since demonstrations started last Tuesday. As Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, protesters were urged yesterday, Sunday, to dress in black.
Kawala, opposition leader of the Cameroon People's Party, CPP, says they are dressed in black as a symbol of sadness over President Paul Biya's long stay in power and persistent brutality against voices opposing his attempt to be president for life. She says dozens of protesters have been arrested or wounded by heavily armed police in several towns, including Cameroon's capital Yaoundé and the economic capital Douala, during the protests.
The police, as you see, they have blocked us, they have shoved us, they will not allow us to talk, they will not allow us to do our job as the political leaders of this country. They have stepped on the rights of citizens.
Kawala, who is a member of a coalition of four opposition political parties, says they will continue the demonstrations until President Paul Biya says no to calls by his ruling party for him to change the constitution and organize early elections. Cameroon government spokesperson Issa Chiruma Bakari says the protests are illegal and will not be allowed to take place.
The fact that you are a politician does not allow you to take the law into your own hand. When you violate the law in such circumstances, the consequences are very well known. What they wanted to have, they had it.
Biya revised the constitution in 2008 to remove presidential term limits. His current mandate ends in 2018. The opposition parties are afraid Biya wants to surprise them by changing the constitution yet again. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Zimbabwe's Indigenization and Economic Empowerment Minister, Patrick Zuwao, says companies that have failed to comply with the government directive to submit indigenization plans will be given another chance before their licenses are revoked. The original deadline was Thursday last week. The country wants foreign-owned companies to transfer majority ownerships to local Zimbabweans. Indigenization Minister Zuwao says he is satisfied so far with the responses the government has received.
One thing that has emerged is that there has been a huge response by people that are seeking to ensure that they are complying with the law. I visited the National Indigenization and Economic Empowerment Board offices earlier on, and over the past couple of weeks, they've really been working flat out, in some instances getting to the office as early as 6 o'clock, and in some instances getting out of the office as late as 10 o'clock. To be able to address all of the requirements. So they still have a significant number of applications that they have received that they still have to process.
What will happen to those who have not complied?
Those that have not complied, really, the process of law requires that the relevant line minister is to notify them that they are non-compliant and request them to show good cause as to why they are non-compliant. Should they not show good cause as to why they are non-compliant, the minister will then request them to comply. Should they fail to comply, the minister will then notify third parties that intention of cancelling their licenses and proceed on to direct the licensing authority to cancel their licenses. It's purely a technical process which is defined at law.
That was Patrick Zuwao, Zimbabwe's Indigenization Minister, speaking with Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe program. A Sudanese tea seller from the Numba Mountains area was honored last week by the U.S. State Department for her courage in organizing the Women's Food and Tea Sellers Cooperative in Khartoum, which now boasts of having more than 8,000 clients, many of them displaced women. Awadiya Makmun is being called a champion of women for challenging social norms and overcoming economic obstacles. IMBO of VOA's South Sudan in Focus program explains.
Awadiya Mahmoud says she is proud of the community of tea sellers she has built in the Sudanese capital because now it is easier for the women to stand up to officials who often harass them or even throw them in jail. Selling tea on the side of the road in Sudan is one of the few ways women like Mahmoud can make money to feed their families. But strict government regulations that favor larger tea companies often prevent them from running independent tea stands. It has taken Mahmoud years of hard work and relentless determination to build up the tea sellers union and the cooperative. That resilience was recognized by the U.S. Department of State at the International Women of Courage Awards ceremony. Mahmoud, who is the second Sudanese woman to receive the award, says the entire experience has been humbling.
Thanks God. Now I am in U.S. I got the award for all Sudanese women, and I will have new work for all Sudan states. Why are they arresting us? They are saying our food is not clean or healthy, and the tea stand are not clean. But if we have a nice place so we can help ourselves and we can be in a good economic situation.
But her achievements have come with a heavy price. Before establishing the cooperatives, Mahmoud said she was jailed on and off for 4 years and often threatened by authorities.
I went to prison because I was helping women and I was distributing free and car rickshaws. I distribute 60 rickshaws to the poor women in Sudan. But unfortunately, the authority did not leave me alone. I continually end up in a prison for 4 years. So I sold my house and my mother's house.
Mahmoud says the harassment from police was constant. She said she knew early on that she would have to organize the tea sellers in order to stand up to the government. She says although she is not formally educated, she knew that her rights were being violated.
I work in public market Khartoum. The problem it was facing me and all Sudanese tea women, that they were arresting us from our place, in the market. But thanks God, we managed to organize ourselves. We framed a union. Now we can rely on ourselves. I'm willing to organize all tea and food sellers in Sudan.
She says it is important that more people stand up to defend their rights so that future generations can thrive. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
It's 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with volleyball. Egypt's El Geish outclassed Tunisia's Esperance in sets of 25-20, 23-25, 27-25 and 25-21 to triumph at the Africa Men's Volleyball Club Championship Final in Cairo, Egypt on Saturday. Egypt's Smuha edged Libya's Sueli by 3-2 to claim the bronze medal in a competition that featured 23 teams from 16 countries. Consequently, El Geish will represent Africa at the World Men's Volleyball Club Championships later this year. Turning to athletics, Kenya's Cyprian Kotut and Wesleyn Jepkesho emerged winners at the Paris Half Marathon in the French capital on Sunday. Kotut clocked 2 hours, 7 minutes and 11 seconds to lead Laban Korir, Stephen Chemlani and Mika Kogo in a 1-2-3-4 Kenyan sweep in the men's race, while Jepkesho covered the distance in 2 hours, 25 minutes and 53 seconds with Ethiopians Gulume Tolesa and Diknesh Mekasha placed second and third, respectively. In South Korea, James Kwambai and Caroline Kilel were crowned winners at the Daegu Marathon on Sunday. Kwambai clocked 2 hours, 10 minutes and 46 seconds to lead John Lagat in a 1-2 Kenyan triumph, with Moroccan Abdellah Tagarhafet placed third. Kilel won the women's race in 2 hours, 27 minutes and 39 seconds. In Germany, Richard Mengech of Kenya clocked 59 minutes and 58 seconds to win the Berlin Half Marathon in the German capital on Sunday. Eritrean Simon Tesfai was runner-up ahead of another Kenyan, Emmanuel Nyagtun. Moving on to football, Kenya held Sudan to a 1-1 draw in Khartoum in the Africa Under-20 Championship qualifiers on Sunday. Guinea dismissed Liberia 2-0. Ethiopia edged Somalia 2-1. Botswana pipped Zimbabwe 1-0. Angola outclassed Chad 3-0. And Algeria edged Mauritania 2-1. Early on Saturday, Rwanda and Uganda drew 1-1. Mozambique pipped Mauritius 1-0 as Swaziland and Namibia drew 2-2. On Friday, Tunisia overpowered Niger 3-0. Meanwhile, Burundi get a bye to the second round after their opponents, the Democratic Republic of Congo, withdrew from the competition. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's a listener mail for this Monday morning, April 4th.
The present hostilities in Burundi is a clear indication that Nkurunziza was not the people's presidential choice. It is therefore requested to step down immediately so as to give peace a chance. I remain Prince John Shin from Obanuku in Obutu Cafe Ranch, Cross River State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your commitment. Please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. And that's it for this Monday, April 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Zubair El Tayeb, I'm James Butte in Washington saying have a lovely day.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the role of development partners in promoting democracy and good governance in Africa. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk. Technology. Does it affect education? Join host Sande Shomari and his guests discussing technology's impact on education. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.